Mao Zedong? Well, Chairman Mao did say a lot, at least enough to fill a little red book. One thing Chairman Mao said was that China must take a great leap forward to surpass the Soviet Union in the race to pure communism. As a consequence of what Chairman Mao said and what his government did, tens of millions of Chinese farmers were worked, beaten, and starved to death. And so we ask, did Mao's government starve 45 million people to death by accident of policy or by act of willful intent?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 945th edition of The Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Firenze who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Hitting What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore at the controls and producer Kelly Bear on the stories. Folks, when all else had been eaten, there were only two things left to eat, and one of them was the good earth. Between 1958 and 1962, China entered into a race to overcome the Soviet Union and become the world's preeminent socialist nation. The strategy, as devised by Communist Party Chairman Mao Zedong, called for a great leap forward in China's industrial output. To make this great leap forward, Mao mobilized China's greatest asset, its peasant farmers, by taking them off their farms and placing them into collectives. Once firmly locked into collectives, farmers were assigned a communal production brigade which had a specific area of responsibility, like making steel or building a dam. Word came down from government as to how much production was demanded of each collective brigade, and government's demands kept growing in size and scope. Soon a conflict developed between the collective's ability to grow food and its ability to make steel or build dams. Something had to give, and it was China's food. As a consequence of Mao's great leap, 45 to 60 million Chinese were worked, beaten, and starved to death. Today, Mao's great leap leads us to ask, how did Chairman Mao take total control of China's farmers? How did Mao's government withhold food from the people who grew the food? And did Mao's government starve 45 million people to death by accident of policy or by act of willful intent? Here to help us explore this very sad piece of human history, we have, direct from the city called the Fragrant Harbor, Frank Decoder, professor of humanities, University of Hong Kong, and author of Mao's Great Famine. Frank, welcome to the Food Chain.
Delighted to be here.
Good to have you aboard, and it's evening in Hong Kong and morning in California. And all we have between us is the Pacific Ocean, right?
Most of it.
Most of it. Well, Frank, when I told, I was speaking with a bright young marketing executive, a college educated gal, yesterday, when I told her I was going to feature Mao's Great Famine on the Food Chain Radio show, she went blank. And I realized she did not know who Mao Zedong was. Hard to believe, but that's the state of things. Who was Mao Zedong?
Mao Zedong was the equivalent of Stalin in the sense that he was the man who established the People's Republic of China. He was the man who turned a quarter of humanity into a communist camp after 1949. And he is the man who is responsible for the greatest mass killing in human history, the one that took place between 1958 and 1962, when at least 45 million people were prematurely, were literally worked or starved to death.
45 to 60 million people.
Yes, he largely exceeds Stalin.
quite a bit. We featured Stalin last week, Stalin's Holodomor last week, and estimates of somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 to 8 million or 9 million people were starved to death in Ukraine. And here we have a case that just exceeds anything beyond the human imagination. And yet it's funny that, you know, you have a bright, young, college-educated marketing executive who have no knowledge of Mao Zedong.
It's all the more worrying in the sense that when we talk about Stalin, of course, he was the leader of the Soviet Union, an empire that is now gone, that belongs to history. And when we talk about Adolf Hitler, he was, of course, the leader of Nazi Germany, which also collapsed a long time ago. But the People's Republic is still with us. The portrait of Mao is still very much hanging in Tiananmen Square, the very heart of the People's Republic in Beijing. He still figures on banknotes. He appears occasionally even on T-shirts of young people who seem unaware of who Mao Zedong was. So the people we are dealing with today in the People's Republic are the direct inheritors of Mao Zedong's regime. Sometimes they are family members. Xi Jinping today is the son of Xi Zhongxun, who was one of Mao Zedong's closest allies.
In a sense, Mao's party became what Mao was fighting against all of those years.
Well, oddly enough, I think he made the mistake of the regime probably became what it detested most.
Yeah. But Frank, how would,
everything is people.
How did you tell us about the moment you decided you're a great observer of Chinese culture? You write about sex, drugs, and rock and roll in the Soviet in the Chinese communist world. How did you come to write this book? Which, I mean, it surely was not something that was sanctioned by the government itself. You had to make a leap here to take on this project. What was the moment you decided I'm going to do this?
Well, it was two things that led to start working on this book, and the most important factor was me moving from the University of London in England to the University of Hong Kong, which is right next door to the People's Republic. I mean, I can literally get on a train in Hong Kong and be in the archives of Guangdong Province a couple of hours later. So the proximity was one thing. But then I realized in 2006, 2007, when I came here, that there was a lot of material in the archives which was open to professional historians like myself and others. Very detailed investigations into cases of cannibalism in the countryside, mass murder, starvation, reports by the Public Security Bureau, minutes from top meetings held by Mao Zedong and his allies, an extraordinary amount of material. And I thought that this was just too good an opportunity to let go. So I really started digging into archives. I spent about 6 months in archives over a period of 3 years putting together all sorts of documents from all sorts of different parts of what is a very, very, very large country. And the result is the book called Mao's Great Famine.
When did you realize the famine, the extent of the deaths from the famine? I mean, you must have had an eye-opening moment when you realized that, oh my goodness, this is far beyond what anybody possibly imagined.
Yeah, it's odd because on the one hand, the sheer extent, the sheer scale of death, the 45 million or plus, is a number I only reached at the very end of my research. But I can tell you something else. It's the manner of death that really took me aback, I think pretty much on the second day that I was in the archives right next to Hong Kong in Guangdong Province. I remember on the second day I was browsing through a folder where it described how villagers in a county called Luoding, about 2 hours by bus from Guangzhou, were literally beaten to death. And first I thought that this was probably something very local, that it might have to do with violence in the South. God knows how the Cantonese can sometimes be very emotional.
Can you hold that? We're going to have to take a quick break as to our time demands. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're talking Mao's Great Famine with the man who wrote the book, Frank Decoder, Professor of Humanities, University of Hong Kong. Stay tuned for a story that will simply blow your mind. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-6 or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-6 or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking with Frank Decoder live from Hong Kong, one of my favorite places on earth. I don't think there's any place more exciting than Hong Kong, and I hope it always stays that way. Is it still that way, Frank?
It's a very dynamic, exciting place. Let's hope it will stay like that for some time.
Well, and speaking of some time, we're looking back in time a little bit, not too far, 50 years now. To the period of 1958 to 1962, four-year period of the Great Leap Forward. And Frank Decoder, being a university professor, was snooping around in some archives in a province really close to Hong Kong right there, right around the corner, as it were. And what did you see in that really captured your attention, Frank?
It was the sheer extent of violence. I expected, of course, that I would find descriptions of people dying of hunger, and there was no lack of that. But what I had completely overlooked is the extent to which terror and systematic violence were very much the foundations of the Great Leap Forward. Every incentive to work was removed for the cultivator. The land belonged to the collective. Tools were collectivized. The grain was taken by the state before villagers could actually get to it. So carters, the local party officials, had to use, basically, the stick to get people to work. And the extent of the violence is really what took me aback. People beaten to death, people made to work half-naked in the middle of the winter, people forced to do atrocious things to each other. In the province of Hunan, sometimes people were punished by being buried alive. Extraordinary levels of violence, a real orgy of horrendous things that were done by people to other people. In Sichuan province, some were actually doused in petrol and set alight. But, of course, the biggest form of punishment in this regime was, of course, hunger. So the point surely must be, but it isn't just that people starved to death. They were starved to death. Food was withheld as a form of punishment. I think it goes back to what Lenin said. Lenin, very much the founding father of the one-party state and of communism. Lenin said, "He who does not work shall not eat." And that principle was applied literally in China during the Great Leap Forward.
So if you didn't satisfy the local cadres, you were starved to death, essentially, or beat to death, one of the two. You know, looking...
If you were too old or too weak or too sick to contribute to the regime through your labor, you were cut off from the canteen, the only place where food was distributed. You were left to die. If you spoke out or you refused to work, or you didn't work hard enough, you could be beaten, you could be punished, and sometimes to death.
or if they just didn't like you for the way you combed your hair or whatever, you could find yourself
on. For some reason, you manage to earn enough work points by laboring all day long for the regime, and then you turn up in the canteen and you queue up with your bowl, and it just so happens that the man in charge of this canteen doesn't like you, he will just skim the surface of the pot and give you some greenish, watery concoction with nothing in it. You will still starve to death.
Well, F.H. King, in his seminal book Farmers of 40 Centuries, described an agriculture that had survived for 40 centuries. And so when Mao and his communist cadre friends showed up on the scene and decided to change this incredible world, they had a lot of work to do. And how did they go about taking total control of the farm? Last week when we were talking about Stalin's Holodomor, the guest talked about how the Communist Party worked in three stages to destroy the fabric of the countryside. And first, they destroyed the people's Weltanschauung, which is essentially the way they see the world. So they came in with their slogans and forced a rethinking of how people see their world. Then they eliminated the churches and simply got rid of the people's faith. Then they corralled the farmers into collectives, and then they fragmented the culture, and that was it. There was nothing left then. Do you see something similar to that in the way Mao took total control of those farmers of 40 centuries?
Absolutely. Mao was a great, assiduous student of Stalin. Stalinism is very much what happened under Mao. And we can say that the very first stage started already in 1949 with so-called liberation. As soon as a village is conquered by the People's Liberation Army, land reform takes place. And that means that villagers have to denounce each other, and the majority is compelled to dispossess and sometimes kill those labeled as landlords, even if those people are hardly better off than their neighbors. In other words, right from the beginning, Mao forces local villagers to physically eliminate their traditional leaders. And then from 1949 to 1957, roughly, anything outside of the party is gradually eliminated. That means religious organizations, Buddhism, Taoism, secret societies, the Catholic Church, civil organizations, anything that smacks of an organized ability to oppose the party is eliminated. And then, of course, very gradually, farmers are herded into collectives. By 1958, they are forced to join massive people's communes where pretty much everything is collectivized. The land is taken back. The tools are shared. The animals belong to the collective. At that stage, nothing stands between the villager and the overall power of the party.
And in these collectives, all personal property, of course, was eliminated, and people had to eat in a common canteen. And you touched upon how that canteen gave the cadres power over everybody. Nobody could escape that, could they?
Indeed. Private kitchens are eliminated. Children are sent to boarding schools. In some communes, man and woman have to sleep separately in dormitories. The whole point here is that Mao sees farmers as foot soldiers in a giant army that he can deploy in one continuous revolution. So when he uses the term of a brigade, that really is what it is. Farmers really become foot soldiers in brigades and platoons, deployed like shock troops in one campaign after the other. And in that system, the food, the only food available, is distributed through the canteens. And the food is in the hands of the party officials. To have a private kitchen, to eat outside of the canteen, is forbidden.
Well, we have a minute or so left here in this segment, but I'd like to start getting into Mao's commands, the commands that would come down from on high for these brigades to do certain kinds of work, such as grow grain, build dams and canals, and make steel. And these brigades were all given commands and were told exactly what to do and how much to do, correct?
Indeed. You could call it government by quota. Everybody is given a quota for grain production, a quota for steel output, a quota for the amount of fertilizer that has to be produced. And then, of course, the other point is that Mao forces many of these villages, communes, counties, entire provinces to compete with each other in the production of steel, of grain, of cotton, you name it.
Well, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. We're going to talk a little bit about what happens when and if the production brigades do not satisfy their quotas. What happens then? Oh, my goodness. This is the Food Chain. We're talking with Frank Decoter, who is the author of Mao's Great Famine. He is in Hong Kong today, and we are here in the United States, but there's nothing that Pacific Ocean can do to hold us from this story. We are going to get it. There is no phone service today. We are pre-recorded because of the great time difference, but you can always talk with us on the forums at metrofarm.com. We will be right back after these very important messages. The central government of the People's Republic of China had its needs, and those needs were to industrialize the country, so they had to go out and borrow money to buy equipment and whatnot. And what did that mean to the peoples out in those communes, Frank Decoter?
The command from above always comes in the form of a quota. There is a demand for grain output, for steel production, and of course they frequently clash. But the local carver has to fulfill and overfulfill the demands for the plan. So he will quite literally whip up the workforce and drive people to fulfill this or that quota, often to their death. And when the grain output can't be reached, the figures are just made up. But of course, once the figures are made up for grain output, the state comes and takes what it sees as its share, its procurement, and very, very little is left behind for the farmers to eat. So a lot of this really results in extraordinary little food left in the villages once the state has come to procure most of it. There are places where literally 80-90% of the harvest is confiscated, and villages are left with a very small amount, which is distributed by the spoonful and only to those who actually contribute to the regime through their labor.
So if you can work, you can get paid but in food. And if you can't work, you do not get paid in food. And what happens to the people then that do not get paid in food?
They starve. Some of them are starved deliberately because they don't contribute to the regime, because they're too old or too weak or too sick, because they're spoken out. Others try to flee, to try to get by and forage in the mountains or somehow escape to the city. Frequently, they are arrested and sent back to the village only to meet punishment at the hands of the local carders. It's a very tough system. By 1960-61, there are villages where you had thousands of people and nothing but a dozen remain. People
Wow.
literally start scavenging everything around them. The bark from trees, they eat the thatch from their own roofs. They will sell everything they have, even the clothes on their own bodies. They will break down their own houses, try to sell the bricks.
And you talk about Guanyin and Yang Li Shi.
Guanyin is a goddess, but Guanyin is also the name of a very white, translucent type of mud, which looks very much like porcelain. And when people are very close to starvation, they start digging up that type of earth. And they either eat it straight, or they will use it to make cakes, mix it up with some bark or with some grass, and pretend that these are cakes. The tragedy, of course, is that once the mud has been ingested, it dries up, and the person who has eaten it will suffer from horrendous constipation. Frequently, the person is so blocked up that it leads to death. It's an absolutely awful way to die.
So when everything else has been eaten, there are only two things left to eat, and one of them is the good earth itself, the guanyin, and the other is?
Well, of course, like in all famines, and this is true for Europe, and it's true, of course, also for the Soviet Union, people start digging up bodies of other people.
You know, here in the United States, we have our own cannibalism story. It's the story of the Donner Party, who got trapped in the Sierras and were forced to eat the remains of human bodies. But in China, it went so much beyond that because there was an actual black market. It was in human body parts for food.
There are reports where in the cities people go to a black market because there is no such thing as a market. It's all in the hands of the state. And people go to a black market and buy some meat only to find a human ear in it. There are stories like that. There are reports by the police compiled at the time that testify to the existence of such stories.
And in those, interesting to note, in those reports that you report on, they list livelihood issues as a cause.
That's the term. Livelihood issues is always the reason given by the Public Security Bureau for cases of cannibalism. This is the reason that is given, livelihood issues. Of course, it's just a politically correct way of saying that these people were really starving to death. But what I always make clear when I talk about this is that when people started digging up bodies and eating them, what they were doing, they were really reduced to doing so. But far greater horrors were inflicted by the state on living human beings. Well, to me, cannibalism is not the worst, if you wish, defilement of the human body during that time. It is what the regime did to living human beings, how it worked or exhausted people to death, which is the really obscene aspect of this whole famine.
Describe the efforts to produce steel and what that meant to those communes of farmers.
The vision by Mao was that the real wealth of China resided in it many millions of people, hundreds of millions of farmers. If only all of them could be turned into foot soldiers, and if all of them could turn to producing steel and backyard furnaces, then steel production would just surge ahead, and China would be able to overtake England in the production of steel. England at the time was still considered to be a major industrial power. But of course, in many of these villages, these backyard furnaces were very poorly built, and the steel that came out was useless. And the tragedy is not so much what came out of it, but what went into it. What went into these backyard furnaces were pots, pans, tools, doorknobs. Just about anything that people could find made of steel went into it.
And what did they fire the...
In the need to fulfill these quotas for steel production imposed by leaders at the county level.
And what did they use to fire those...
Waste of resources.
What did they use to fire those furnaces, Frank?
Say it again?
What did they use to fire those furnaces?
They used wood. And here's another tragedy. Of course, we talk about how human beings were destroyed during this period. But there was also an extraordinary assault on nature, as farmers were obliged to fan through the forest and chop down trees like never before to fan the fires of these backyard furnaces that produced very little of any value. So not only were farmers confronted with an absolute lack of pots, pans, tools to work the land, but they were surrounded by cut down forests, hills devoid of any forest at all.
Hold on, Frank. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. This is The Food Chain. Mao said it best himself when he said that revolution is no dinner party. And so to change the way farmers of 40 centuries were doing things, he had to really turn the country literally upside down and inside out, to the extent that almost nothing was left. Nothing. What was left after they built their dams and they made their steel? What did the countryside look like, Frank Decoder?
It was quiet, eerily quiet, because there were no animals left, because the people were pretty much, those still alive, were starved into silence. Very few trees had been chopped down. A landscape that was also, strangely enough, devoid of many houses. In a province of, like, Hunan, which is about the size of France, 40% of the houses were destroyed simply because people tried to sold the bricks, or the bricks were needed to build canteens, or they were used as fertilizer on the soil. So it was really a landscape that would probably remind you of Europe in 1945, bombed out.
And a consequence of the Great Leap Forward. Now, sooner or later, there had to, you know, come to grips with the fact that you can make steel and you can build aqueducts and dams, and then you also have the need to grow food. And sooner or later, when you deconstruct all of those farms of 40 centuries and turn them into massive communes with the responsibility of making steel and building dams, something has to give, and it was the food, right?
Yes. Well, yes and no, in the sense that food was still being produced, but most of it was taken away to feed factories in the cities, to feed the cities themselves, to feed the army, and, of course, also to export to the Soviet Union to pay for all the equipment that China was buying at the time in order to fuel its great leap forward and catapult China past all its competitors. So the real tragedy is, of course, that for a country that proclaimed its belief in total equality, there was a very, very strict hierarchy, and the losers were the cultivators, the very producers of the food themselves in the countryside.
And once again, how can you take food from the people who grew the food and still get them to grow the food?
There's only one way that it could be done at the time, and that was by the use of systematic violence and terror, by placing all the available food in the hands of the carters who had to whip up the workforce. Not a very pleasant regime. And, of course, not a regime that was able to last. The whole thing collapsed by 1962, and China was forced to somehow revert back to a less radical vision of collectivization.
How did that process work? You know, once you get everything completely turned upside down and inside out, and it fails, then what did they do? I mean,
the sheer scale of devastation in terms of human beings, damage to the environment, collapse of the transportation system, the erosion of the whole fabric of society, the scale of the devastation was such that by 1961, the Communist Party was obliged to revert back to earlier years and allow farmers to go back and have a private plot. And it's those private plots that really managed China to get out of that horrendous famine.
So he had essentially to give up Mao did. What did Mao do then?
In part. Only small private plots were allowed. The collectives remained in place. The people's communes were not abolished until the 1980s. But in practice, most of the food came from those very tiny private plots that farmers were somehow allowed to cultivate.
And when China really started coming to grips with the fact that the Great Leap Forward really was a kind of like a great leap backwards, how did Mao hold on to power?
Well, it's a long, complicated story, but it can be summarized in two words: cultural revolution. He launched the cultural revolution in 1966, 4 years after the end of the famine, and it was an attempt to get rid of every leader in the party who was critical of what Mao had done to his country during the Great Leap Forward.
So those people who stood up and said the Great Leap Forward did not work found themselves...
Not just very few stood up and said the Great Leap doesn't work. One or two did. The vast majority somehow had grudges. And Mao eliminated anybody and everybody who he even remotely suspected of having expressed any form of even mild discontent with the Great Leap Forward. By 1966, this is a very old and paranoid man, willing to get rid even of long-standing colleagues who had worked with him side by side for 30, 40 years.
It was a culture of people and not of laws.
It was a culture of power, a culture of absolute power, where one man's dictate was very much what set the country on its course to self-destruction.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, folks, but when we come back, I want to ask Frank Decoter, author of Mao's Great Famine, the big question. Did Mao's government starve 45 million people to death by accident of policy or by willful intent, an act of willful intent? I mean, after all, they had to do something to turn over 40 centuries of tradition. Do stay tuned, right back. The philosopher Santayana said, "Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it in the future." And so for the past 2 weeks on The Food Chain, we have been remembering the past so as we do not repeat it in the future. Last week, we looked back to Stalin's great Holodomor. The word Holodomor can be translated into something like man-caused famine. Joseph Stalin and his government's Holodomor consisted of taking food away from the recalcitrant, freedom-loving people of the Ukraine, which caused many of them to simply starve to death. The extent of this Holodomor, the existence of which was denied by the New York Times, only recently came to light with the opening of archives in countries that were formerly part of the Soviet Union. There, in the archives, was proof that 7 million Ukrainians were indeed simply starved to death by Joseph Stalin and henchmen. But when it comes to starving people to death, Stalin was a mere tenderfoot compared to his communist protege, Mao Zedong. In fact, it was the launching of the Sputnik satellite that encouraged Mao to succeed the Soviet Union as the world's preeminent socialist country. And so Mao's race to the top was on, a race aptly chronicled in Professor Frank Decoter's Mao's Great Famine. Decoder's discoveries were made possible by the opening of collective archives throughout China, archives that had been closely guarded by China's Communist Party. Mao's Great Famine takes us from the capitals of communism to the villages where that communism was lived out, and allows us to see what Chairman Mao did to transform his nation. And throughout its pages, we can learn the story of history's greatest catastrophe of human suffering. It was a big job, turning over 40 centuries of tradition, and Chairman Mao decided to do it with his Great Leap Forward, and so turned China inside out and upside down. To the extent that there was nothing left, everything had been eaten except the good earth itself, and. I had a good friend, college roommate, who is now a retired school superintendent who went to China, and he came back and reported that the young people he talked to were firmly convinced that the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward were necessary to forge the new China out of the old China. Frank Decoder, how do you see that great period of time in which China took its great leap and in its successive and the succession Cultural Revolution? Do you think it was necessary to forge
the 3 decades under Mao, from 1949, when the People's Republic is established, all the way to the death of the good old man himself in 1976, are 3 decades of extraordinary destruction of human beings, of housing, of nature, the fabric of society, of whatever holds society together. It's a huge, massive hole dug by the Communist Party of China, out of which people were somehow allowed to climb out after 1979 with economic reforms. There's no way you could describe those 3 decades of destruction as being somehow necessary. What we have before 1949 is a Republican period which thrived in many ways. So it would be a little bit comparable to saying that Nazi Germany was necessary in order for Germany to somehow become the economic superpower it is today. Of course, there's no relationship between the one and the other.
Do you think it's possible for another Chairman Mao to show up on the scene in today's world?
It would be a very different one, but never say never. Let's not forget that in the middle of 1960, as this horrendous famine was claiming literally tens of millions of lives, people in Europe were saying that what had happened during the Second World War, the Holocaust in particular, should never be allowed to happen again. And very much during that time, François Mitterrand, who would become president of France, was in China and came back to report that there was no such thing as famine under Mao Zedong. There were only shortages. So even as Europeans were looking back at their own history, they were very much portraying China as a success story, even as tens of millions of their people were being beaten, starved to death.
Frank Decoder, were I the president of the world, I would force every public school child to read Mao's Great Famine. Thank you for joining us, Frank. Really appreciate it. This has been The Food Chain. Thank you all for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.